From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings. Early church history and Byzantine art, those are the topics this week on Soundings. My guests are two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center. First on this edition of Soundings, a discussion with Robert Nelson of the University of Chicago, followed by a conversation featuring Raymond Van Dam of the University of Texas. Robert Nelson is an historian of Byzantine art. One of the focal points of his scholarship is the question of audience response among then-contemporary Byzantine audiences. Okay, well, Rob Nelson, let's be specific. One of the, we have a handicap here. We're on the radio. We don't have the advantage of pictures. One of the icons, one of the images that you used in a recent talk here at the Humanities Center, focuses on the figure of Christ. Mm-hmm. And at the bottom of the image or the icon, the picture, there is a textual message. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, as simply as possible, describe this image for me, and mm-hmm. then let's talk about how the image communicates to a then medieval audience.
Okay. The image in question is in an 11th century Psalter, which means a Psalter in New Testament in this case, and it prefaces the 77th Psalm, which begins, quote, "Give heed, O my people, to my law. Incline your ear to the words of my mouth." Mm-hmm. What I've tried to do is think about that text in terms of the image which is directly above, which consists merely of a bust of Christ, a bust-length portrait of Christ, who gestures with one hand, his right hand, and his left hand, he holds a book. That image, let me return to something you said at the beginning, that image doesn't speak to us. That image doesn't say very much to us. It sort of sits there quietly on the page and seems to be nothing more than a bust-length portrait of Christ holding a book and gesturing with one hand. Mm-hmm. Well, how could we understand what that particular image communicated to an 11th century reader of this particular page of this manuscript? Well, I tried to think about medieval attitudes toward icons like this, and I find that the icon, the religious image, had a direct, tangible link with the person portrayed, in this case, Christ. That is, the image was meant to be, meant to not just symbolize Christ, but in some way be Christ, so that a prayer directed toward that image of Christ was a prayer directed actually to Christ. Furthermore, I found that that particular gesture of one hand signifies speech in the Middle Ages, and so that this image of Christ was actually thought to be speaking. So Wayne, I think it's, in this case, this particular image in a Byzantine Psalter of the 11th century is, curiously enough, a very interesting one to talk about on radio.
Right.
Because it is a talking picture. Uh-huh. It is an image that communicated to the medieval beholder because it was thought to be saying something.
Well, we have two key words in ear and mouth.
Right.
But the other side of that coin, Rob Nelson, is the problem of literacy, is it not? You're telling me now about basically an oral tradition or an oral culture. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you're describing a picture accompanied by words. Mm-hmm. Not everybody could understand that, I take it. Does that present you with an obstacle?
Well, I think that's certainly correct. Obviously, the person that had this particular book open to this particular page, to this particular text, could read. Otherwise, he wouldn't have had, or she wouldn't have had the, wouldn't have been holding this very expensive book. But the larger question here, the larger problem is, I think we, in order to understand that 11th century perception, we must realize very consciously that texts in the Middle Ages were perceived orally, mm-hmm. just as we're talking now. One's texts were read out loud.
By the priest, I take it?
By the priest and by you and me. If we had this Psalter open, I dare say we would have we would be saying those words out loud. Silent reading, as you and I were taught in elementary school, and right. the teacher chastised us if we moved our lips, etc. Yeah. That was that's what you did in the Middle Ages. You uh-huh. read out loud. There's a story told once about Saint Ambrose, who was seen overseen one time reading silently, and the observer couldn't fathom what was going on because the saint wasn't yeah. actually reading out loud.
Mm-hmm. As an art historian, do you stop there? Do you immerse yourself what in the larger sort of social and political, even economic dimensions of this question in order to recreate this medieval mind and this medieval audience? I'm inviting you to overcomplicate your subject for me.
Right, and I'm trying very carefully to. to be simple. Well, I think you have to. Precisely because if you want to really understand the significance of some past artifact, there are a whole host of modern reactions to a phenomena that one must dispel. For mm-hmm. example, let's just take the concept of book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you and I have many, many books at our house and in our offices. Books are very common. Nothing is more common in a than a book almost in our world. Well, books were not common before the invention of printing. It's mm-hmm. it's usually said, and quite correctly, that printing meant that books could be produced much less expensively. Before the advent of printing, the kind of book that I'm talking about would have cost could have cost the salary of, let's say, a middle-level bureaucrat in the Byzantine government. Now,
a whole year's salary?
A whole year's salary. Yeah. I mean, we can factor that into our experience and say that's the equal of a certain GS scale in the federal government or something like that.
Right.
But the point is, it's a lot of money, uh-huh. many thousands of dollars. So a book, a rich, luxurious book, would have cost many thousands of dollars in our terms. So it's definitely not a trivial object. I'm not studying popular pulp fiction or something like that.
Right.
I'm studying something that cost a great deal, and a great deal of attention was paid to it. The third aspect of this, of course, that every book is unique. We have books that are reproduced and editions of tens of thousands and multiple printings.
Mm-hmm.
Every medieval manuscript is unique. It's a handcrafted object, just like a piece of a beautiful pottery that we buy from a potter. It is
yeah.
unique.
Mm-hmm. Rob Nelson, tell me about the role of the artist. We're discussing your work, your investigation into the relationship between iconography, pictures, images, and a medieval audience. Am I to assume here that there was a sort of collective mind on the part of the artists who composed, created these icons, that they consciously or otherwise had some set of beliefs about this larger audience that they were trying to reach with these pictures?
Well, I think you are to assume that. That's
mm-hmm.
that's a very good way of characterizing it. Again, I would return to my notion of dispelling modern attitudes. We have a sense of an artist today, and one needn't describe what our modern sense of an artist is, other than say that it's different
yeah.
for a medieval artist.
Right.
I think we'd be more apt to think of a medieval artist as an artisan.
Mm-hmm. More of a craftsman.
A craftsman, a person that, like a carpenter or mm-hmm. a plumber or a gardener or somebody that performs a very useful function in society, but not a great genius.
That yeah, less what? Creative than synthetic.
Yes.
Bringing things together that
uh-huh.
people already knew about.
And what little we know exactly about to return to your question, the role of the artist, there's one church council that actually discusses this
uh-huh.
and says the role of the church is in the disposition of the works of art, which means basically everything having to do to the meaning, to the iconography, to the subject matter of the work of art. The province of the artist merely includes the sort of making of the object. That is, whether you're going to make a mosaic or you're going to make a fresco, things of this sort. But the actual meaning, the significance of the work of art is the domain of the church when we're talking about Eastern Christian religious art in the High Middle Ages.
Tell me about this, Rob Nelson. In the modern sensibility, well, I won't generalize too far. I look at the pictures that you deal with, icons, images, illustrations, and pictures from the High Middle Ages. And one reaction might be, man, this is stuff from another planet. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't look like this. These are one-dimensional. They don't look real at all. The question is this. Would a medieval audience have looked at this stuff and said, here is the real world, unquote, quote unquote, or this is an ideal world? How do you figure that out? Were they supposed to identify with these icons or see something otherworldly, transcendent, the spiritual in all of this?
Well, I think it's the latter, really. They are to see this as something otherworldly. To make an image.
And yet it had to have some meaning in their everyday mundane lives.
Right.
Somehow.
Well, the meaning, the significance, the everyday significance to the work of art comes less from how it's painted, how it looks, to, that meaning comes from the religious belief that the image of Christ is in some way connected to Christ.
So it wasn't the aesthetics of what they were looking at. It was the, theological or religious transcendence or importance. Rob Nelson, tell me how your investigations into the question of audience, the relationship among and between viewer or perceiver, artist and subject in the High Middle Ages, these Byzantine images that you were looking at, how does that help our understanding of modern art? How does it somehow enrich our understanding of the history of art? Is it a single chapter? Do you find continuities that come to us in the modern world?
Well, I think it's there are so many ways to answer that question, which I think is really very fundamental to anybody's project, any humanist that's dealing with the past. On the one hand, I think it's just plain interesting to find out about the things that are going on in the past. On the other hand, to understand the way images communicate in the Middle Ages, that whole inquiry comes from a modern perception. I believe modern painting today is, in a way, seeking ways to communicate to its audience today. On the other hand, what I'm trying to deal with, these pictures that are in manuscripts which were read out loud, I think is curiously perfectly appropriate for a radio audience, because the way in which our audience that's listening to us right now is hearing our words is similar to the way that audience in a medieval church would have heard the text read from a book by a priest and would then be looking at some sort of image. So there's something very similar to the kind of oral dialogue we're having now to this fundamentally oral experience that the medieval audience had in the 11th century Constantinople.
Minus, we can hope, the repetition. Am I right?
I hope so. I hope so.
Robert Nelson is a professor at the University of Chicago. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Nelson worked on a forthcoming book about Byzantine art. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Art and Early Church History continues now with a conversation featuring another scholar at the center. Raymond Van Dam is a professor at the University of Texas. During his fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Raymond Van Dam worked on a forthcoming study of three early church fathers, Basil of Caesarea, Gregory of Nazianzus, and Gregory of Nyssa.
The reason I was attracted to the Cappadocian fathers is not because they're great theologians, which they are, but rather because their literature gives us information about other aspects of the Roman Empire and this particular region. Conventionally, the standard way of treating the Cappadocian fathers is as writers of great theology. So the current scholarship on the Cappadocian fathers focuses upon their theology, their role in the making of Christian doctrine. What I want to do with the Cappadocian fathers is look at other topics that they treat, usually just peripherally. For instance, one topic that I'm interested in is the history of families. Now, we know a fair amount about the Cappadocian Fathers themselves. We also know a fair amount about their parents, and in some cases, even their grandparents. So it's possible to trace out the history of this, of these two families throughout the entire 4th century. Now, this is interesting because during the 4th century, we find such things as the conversion of Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, who was the first emperor to convert to Christianity. So here we have the switch from paganism to Christianity. And remarkably enough, these families are caught up in this switch. Mm-hmm. For instance, the father of Gregory of Nazianzus goes almost immediately from being a pagan to a Christian. In fact, he even becomes a Christian bishop. In other words, here's a man who moves with the times.
Indeed.
The grandparents of Basil and Gregory of Nyssa are at the opposite end of the spectrum because they're initially persecuted because they're Christians under a pagan government. Once the emperor becomes Christian, this family comes into its own, and Basil and some of his brothers become bishops. So here's two families now that react in different ways to the coming of Christianity. Let me give you one example from the career of Basil, because Basil is typically taken as the leader of the three, at least while he's still alive. Basil is interesting because his father dies when he's comparatively young, and thereafter, Basil consistently has problems with authority figures from his father's generation.
There's nothing new in that.
Nothing new is right. For instance, Basil has a falling out with the current bishop of Caesarea, who presumably is his father's age. He also has eventually a falling out with one of his uncles, looks to be his mother's brother. So here again are a couple of men from his father's generation with whom Basil has great difficulty. On the other hand, Basil consistently gets along well with men of his grandparents' generation or men who remind him of his grandparents' experiences.
You got a hopscotch effect there.
Yeah. Now, the overriding or the most noted experience of his grandparents' generation had been their sufferings during the persecutions under the last pagan emperors.
When they were converting over.
Right.
Okay.
So Basil consistently relates well to men who continue to be persecuted, as he describes it, persecuted for whatever reason. Now, this is interesting because Basil himself eventually becomes bishop at Caesarea. So in a sense, he finally bypasses his father's generation, and he becomes metropolitan bishop of the entire region of Cappadocia. Once he becomes bishop, Basil then conceptualizes his tenure as bishop in terms of persecution. So once he becomes bishop, he tends to imitate the experiences of his grandparents.
How do you, what kind of language do you use to describe this? The direction of the church, its the underpinnings of its theology?
Let me put this in still a wider context. Basil is caught up in a number of theological controversies. Now, in the long run, Basil is vindicated. He becomes one of the great Greek fathers. But at the moment, one way of interpreting some of these controversies is they're virtually controversies of Basil's own making. In other words, he needs these controversies in order to put himself into this context of persecution. So in some respects, it's Basil who is the figure who is unable to accommodate, and it's Basil who needs to be rigid and austere and heavy-handed just to ensure that he has this opposition and he can therefore see himself as a persecuted figure. The overriding theological issue in the 4th century has to do with the definition of the Trinity. In particular, since the early 4th century, one of the overriding questions had been the correct and proper relationship between the Father and the Son within the Trinity, the first and the second persons of the Trinity.
And just parenthetically, this is an echo of what you've been telling me about the relationships among and between these three Cappadocian fathers.
Precisely, and that's exactly what I was leading up to.
Sure.
Here you have the Cappadocian fathers contributing to the definition of the Trinity.
Right.
One of the underlying metaphors of the Trinity is this relationship between Father and Son. Now, I haven't worked this out yet, but my guess is that personal experiences are somehow going to influence, either positively or negatively, their definitions of the Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
And so effectively, their personal experiences are going to influence the metaphor that they use to conceptualize various aspects of the Trinity.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is important because theology, when you come at the most basic level, theology is essentially an attempt to know the unknowable, say the ineffable, mm-hmm. speak about the unspeakable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty obvious that people are going to have to resort either to philosophy, which has been developed
mm-hmm.
elsewhere in this long Greek philosophical tradition, or they're going to start resorting to metaphors, comparisons, and that sort of stuff.
They're looking for models.
Yes, they have to use models because there's always this gap between what they know and what they're trying to get at.
Mm-hmm.
Another aspect of my research has to do with the workings of the Roman Empire. In other words, I'm going to use Cappadocia as one region in which to investigate in miniature how the Roman Empire actually worked,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to how the emperors wanted it to work or mm-hmm. other people described it as working. So I'm going to investigate the interaction between emperors and imperial magistrates on one level,
mm-hmm.
and men with local authority. Now, men with local authority are large landowners because of the importance of land in the ancient world, local municipal magistrates, and bishops.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in some cases, these categories overlap. For instance, the Cappadocian fathers themselves were large landowners. So I'm interested in this this interaction between the imperial administration and men with local authority.
What was special then in terms of political administration? And connect that also to these underpinnings of theological issues as well as what, purely political or secular ones?
Well, what was special then is, on the one hand, by definition and probably in reality, the emperor, imperial magistrates, and the army have a monopoly upon force.
Uh-huh.
For instance, the emperor is described in one source, not the Cappadocian Fathers, but another contemporary source. The emperor is described as a man who carried death at the tip of his tongue. In other words, he could do almost anything he wanted just by saying he wanted to do it.
You die and you
die.
That's
right. On the other hand, when it comes down to, say, the implementation of imperial policy or mm-hmm. even the collection of taxes, emperors and imperial magistrates are very dependent upon these men with local authority.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this interaction in the sense that emperors are dependent upon local men in order to carry out their wishes.
There has to be some goodwill flowing in both directions.
Absolutely. And these men with local authority are dependent upon the imperial administration in order to make themselves look good as local brokers mm-hmm. or to acquire offices, higher status, or whatever it is that they want.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this constant implicit negotiation going on between these various levels, and they're essentially, or they're in many respects, helpless and weak without the other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, think about the wider theological implications of this. Again, when the Cappadocians develop their theology of God, the power of God, they consistently make comparisons with the emperor,
mm-hmm.
because the emperor is the most powerful figure that they know of.
That's
even if they don't know him firsthand,
sure.
they have this image of the emperor.
Yeah.
And so again, there's this merging between imperial authority, definitions of the authority and power of God,
mm-hmm.
and a number of different levels seem to interlock with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just put this into the context of what's going on in history. A number of
you mean historical scholarship.
Historical scholarship.
Right.
A number of very important books have come out recently which follow exactly this sort of model.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, this book by Leroy Lagerie on Montaillou. Here's a man who found one specific village in the 14th century about which he knew a great deal because he had the Inquisition records.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to use this village as a miniature or a paradigm for wider French society. So this is very common among historians now to find a small topic and then try to blow it up
mm-hmm.
and tease out these wider implications.
Mm-hmm.
So that's essentially what I'm trying to do for the Roman Empire. Cappadocia is important, the Roman Empire is important, but then there are these much wider issues that ought to be introduced into scholarship on the later Roman Empire.
Well, Ray Van Dam, let's look at this question of society, culture, theology, theological models, families, in terms of then contemporary circumstances. What's the big deal? We also have, what, a large number of people who are not Cappadocian fathers, who are not sophisticated theologically. Is this stuff important to them? How was it important to them?
Now, that's a very important question, because generally the Cappadocian fathers are treated in a context, a two-dimensional context. We still read these histories of Christian dogma, but it looks as if these ideas are just being thought up in a vacuum.
Yeah, we see them in sort of freeze frame, chiseled in granite, and as you said earlier, you're trying to humanize them.
And some of them are now right, and many of them are now wrong. They've been dismissed.
They've been voted on.
What I'm interested in is the kinds of audiences for these ideas. In other words, these men are not just great theologians, they're also bishops, and they're responsible for their congregations and their communities. Now, we have some sermons from these men in which they're clearly talking about this new theology. They're also justifying their own theology, but they are talking about this theology to a wider audience. And you ask yourself the obvious question, how much would these people have understood of this sophisticated, highly technical theology?
A lot or a little? What?
Well, I think there are various ways in which the Cappadocians can sidestep some of the inherent sophistication in these ideas. For instance, in many of their sermons, they're talking about saints and saints' cults. One way of communicating a particular idea is not to talk about the idea itself in the abstract, but rather to personify it as the saint.
Oh, this goes back to Christ in the allegories and, you know, sort of local symbols, as it
right.
were.
So here is a man who lived out these correct ideas, and his behavior only makes sense within this correct theological context.
Mm-hmm.
But this also means now that these people, instead of having an idea that they're supposed to figure out, they now have a model.
Yeah.
And they know how they're supposed to behave. So I'm interested in these implicit rules that somehow determine people's behavior and even govern the way that they can think about things.
Raymond Van Dam teaches at the University of Texas. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Raymond Van Dam worked on a forthcoming study of early church history. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Byzantine Art and Early Church History, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, conversations about modern African history and Afro-American studies in the United States. My guests will be Jonella Butler of Smith College and Harold Marcus of Michigan State University. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Listen to Soundings. This is Kim Nielsen at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join Wayne Pond this week for conversations about Byzantine art and early church history. Wayne's guests are Robert Nelson of the University of Chicago and Raymond Van Dam of the University of Texas. Byzantine art and its audiences, and the shaping of early church history. Some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.